Hello and welcome to the Roughing the Kicker Kansas City Chiefs podcast. I'm your host, Joshua Briscoe. On today's show, we're going to do some over-under predictions for the Chiefs next year, break down the wide receiver position before training camp, check in on the AFC West, some comments from listeners, looking in at the defensive back position, something interesting there I think we should talk about. There's news about quarterbacks and OTAs are going on. But before we get to any of that, I want to say welcome if you're new to this show, because there's good reason for you to be. Starting right now, this show is a part of Blog Talk Radio, which is the world's largest online talk radio and podcasting hosting platform. Last week, I had a chance to talk with Jay Soderberg, also known as Pod Vader, formerly of ESPN and the czar of ESPN's podcast. Had a great conversation about Blog Talk Radio and about this show. So you can now get this show not only on Arrowhead Addict, not only on iTunes, but now on TuneIn and Stitcher, other major quote-unquote podcatchers. I'm really excited about where this show is going. I hope you are also. But what you're really here for is not me. Is to talk about where the Kansas City Chiefs are going next year, and I have a crystal ball to share with you. We will play the over-under game here very soon, but I think one of the factors that is going to most influence this next Chiefs season, if you've been listening to the show for a while, you know, I think the offensive line is always a key, but I think it's going to settle down. The defensive backs scare me the most. But the second position group on this list, I think, is the most volatile for the Chiefs going forward, is the wide receivers. Now, on the last show, we talked a lot about Chris Conley's potential, compared him to some other receivers in Andy Reid's system in their second year. So, Jeremy Maclin, DeSean Jackson, several, I think we went through four or five or six second-year receivers in Reid's systems. So if you want to hear about that, go back to last week's show. But there's something more from Conley here that was passed along from a commenter on Arrowhead Addict. This is a little write-up from pass2win.com. They had a nice little article overall about second-year jumps that frequently apply to wide receivers, and they had a specific short write-up here I'm going to touch on about Chris Conley. It was Andy in the comments on Arrowhead Addict last show. If you ever want to share anything with me, to either for the show, comments, suggestions, ideas, you can follow me on Twitter at jbbriscoe and shoot anything under 140 characters that way. Longer stuff, you can either throw in the comments on arrowheadaddict.com, where the show shows up every week, and on Facebook at facebook.com/RTKshow. So thanks to Andy for bringing this up to my attention. Here's what Pass to Win wrote about Chris Conley. And they were talking about fantasy football, so we're going to cut out the fantasy football bits and try to figure out what this means for Chris Conley as a player. It says, quote, "You can have all the skills, speed, size, and know-how in the league, but if opportunities are not headed your way, lowered expectations are on the call," which they say is the case for Chris Conley, which I inherently disagree with a little bit. They also say something I disagree with entirely. "The Chiefs don't put the ball in the air often enough to boost Conley's 2016 projections higher than double his meager rookie stats. Lead receiver Jeremy Maclin gets the lion's share of wideout targets for the Chiefs, while Conley and Albert Wilson vie for the scraps." They think if Conley were in a pass first scheme, he would be one of the highest ceilings for potential breakout candidates for this season, but they don't think the offense fits him. Quote, "Given his expected limited targets he'll see this season, it's difficult to see Conley surpassing 35 or 40 catches. He has the explosiveness to do damage with 40 catches, maybe 15 yards per reception and 5 to 6 touchdowns, but he'll need Maclin on the sidelines to make fantasy football hay this season." Again, scooping up the fantasy football bits. That sounds like someone who doesn't watch the Chiefs' offense very often. What's true is that Andy Reid and Alex Smith together have not pushed the ball down the field very often, historically in their own, at least in Alex Smith's history. I think you could get DeSean Jackson and Jeremy Maclin and Terrell Owens to all argue the other side of that for Andy Reid's history, which is why I think what Alex Smith currently lacks, or at least what Andy Reid has lacked, is a downfield threat opposite another receiver that is any good at all. In this case, Jeremy Maclin, who I think quite highly of. I don't know if Alex Smith has the physical tools to utilize that downfield guy. We've seen him try that some, but in a lot of cases, we've seen Smith try and fail because he was trying to get it to Albert Wilson, who is a fine slot receiver and a fine developmental player, but is not a stretch-the-field kind of guy. He doesn't have the speed for it, doesn't have the size for it, and sometimes he gets alligator arms, which is really strange to me, but I'm going to leave that Albert Wilson point to the side. This is from another commenter on Arrowhead Addict, from Chris, talking about Chris Conley. So he said he came from Georgia, a Georgia system that was very basic in the pass game and was very run-heavy. On top of that, his preseason injury really limited his exposure to first-team reps. It seemed like by the end of the year, Conley had really gotten to the point where he felt comfortable in the system and was grasping the mental aspect quite well. My belief, he goes on, says, "My belief has been that his jump in year two will mostly depend on the amount of first-team reps he gets in the preseason. Think if Alex Smith and him get the chance to build the chemistry that is crucial for quarterback and wide receiver, it could lead to a very big year. I have no problem with any of that, that side of it. But then I read the numbers that Chris put in the comments, and it sounded insane, comparing him to Antonio Brown. This is more than I usually read at the beginning of a show, but I think this paragraph is fascinating, so hear me out. From Chris: last preseason, I read an article that mentioned how Conley was flying through notebooks with his note-taking. Later that year, during the season, somebody highlighted how his quality is what, how this quality is what made Antonio Brown special. Brown jumped from 16 receptions, 167 yards, and no touchdowns his first year to 1,100, and two in his second year. If Conley receives these first-team reps and builds that chemistry, I think it'd be very reasonable to see 5 receptions on 8 targets a game with about a 5 to 20-yard average due to big plays that he'll get based on his speed. Pausing there, does anyone have a huge problem with the idea that maybe Conley could get 5 receptions with 15 yards per reception? That seems reasonable enough. Let's back that down to 4 receptions with 15 yards per reception, which is a pretty high rate, but that seems very reasonable for Chris Conley. Well, multiply that over 16 games, and you've got almost a 1,000-yard season for Chris Conley. That's 960 yards, if you want to take that. And then just the 4 times 16 for just receptions, 64 catches. 64 catches and 960 yards would be a tremendous second-year campaign for Chris Conley. Again, my first shiver there is that last number sounds way too big. But in his second year as a smart guy, a trusted guy with great physical tools in this Andy Reid system, where Alex Smith is going to trust him, Reid is going to trust him, the offensive line is going to give Alex Smith that time again like we started to see happen in the second half of last season, I don't know why Chris Conley wouldn't get those opportunities. Now, the rookie wide receivers coming in and Travis Kelce and getting the rest of that tight end group healthy again, having 3 running backs that all will demand touches, which is a good thing and something we'll talk about in the over-unders later on. Those are all factors you could use to argue against what Chris Conley will get. But if you're throwing him the ball 6 times a game and he's catching 4 of them, if you spread those numbers out and say a couple of duds here and a couple of absolute shot out of a rocket types of games here for Conley, give him 4 catches a game for 60 yards a game, that's a heck of a season. And that saying it that way feels very, very plausible. Now, also sticking with the receivers and moving on from Chris Conley a little bit, just that's our last. I think Chris Conley's the most interesting player, the most interesting, at least second-year player, most interesting developmental player even, on this Chiefs roster. The cornerbacks are going to be the most important. Chris Conley will be the next most important for how these young guys develop. The only reason he's more interesting than Marcus Peters is because Marcus Peters is really, really good right now. And Chris Conley, I think, for all these guys, has probably the highest ceiling and the lowest floor, because third-round receivers come into the league and do nothing all the time. Andy Reid has had high-picked receivers come into his system and do nothing. I believe in Chris Conley, and I think that explosiveness that he can provide to this offense is something that it's lacked for so many years. And overall, this offense is absolutely filled with weapons. Again, getting ahead of myself on the over-unders, we'll get there in a second. Let's look at the rest of the wide receivers, though, on this team. From Roger in the comments at Arrowhead Addict. He said, Conley, Streeter, Williams, Macklin, Hammond is who he was picking for the receivers, with Brown and Cook battling for the last spot, and no one else makes the team, including Tyreek Hill, DeAnthony Thomas, and Albert Wilson. I think that's super wrong, and let's break it down real quick. The locks here are Jimmy Macklin and Chris Conley. Those guys, there's nothing that could happen to have those guys not be on the roster next year. Easy. Near locks here, by my estimation, Albert Wilson, who is, you know, in a way a veteran of this group, and also does something that no one else in this team is doing super well right now. Albert Wilson, DeMarcus Robinson, he's a 4th-round pick, he's going to make the team, and Tyreek Hill. If you want to hear more about Tyreek Hill, and you're new to this show, go back to the post-draft episode. There's a lot on these rookies, and then there's a lot on Tyreek Hill. And then last week, we talked about how John Dorsey is still does not know how to say the right things here. There's no chance that they went out and got Tyreek Hill, they already went through the PR nightmare of this whole situation. It's not going to get worse unless something terrible happens to Tyreek Hill. The only way that gets worse is if they go, well, not only did we misjudge his character and the public relations nightmare it would bring, we also misjudge his football ability. Chiefs are not going to let that happen. Tyreek Hill's going to make the roster. Then what that puts on the bubble then, Rod Streeter, DeAnthony Thomas, Frankie Hammond, and Mike Williams, long shots, guys like Kenny Cook, Daron Brown, Kashif Moore. I don't know how you argue a lot of that going into training camp. if you want to argue that DeAnthony Thomas could keep Tyreek Hill off the roster, that's the only out I see for the Chiefs is keeping anyone, but really would be DeAnthony Thomas, and saying, we brought in two guys to compete, and DeAnthony Thomas took the job back. With all of his stuff last season that kept him out of so many games, that would surprise me a little bit. I think the Chiefs went to Hill because they said, we need to upgrade this spot. Maybe they don't trust DeAnthony Thomas anymore, I don't know. The rest of those bubble guys are all, one of those bubble guys will likely make it. I have a soft spot for Mike Williams, talked about that a little bit last week also. He showed such great flashes early on in Tampa Bay, then kind of disappeared for a couple of years, battled injuries. I think of all of those bubble guys, he has the greatest potential. So I think Rod Streeter's the favorite to make it from that group. The release time of this podcast has been a little bit up and down and backwards and forwards because of sorting out new things with Blog Talk Radio and the last podcast host I was using. So doing shows during OTAs is hard anyway because there's a tremendous amount of not really news type of news, even more so when you don't know when a show's going to be published. But the most interesting thing that's happened so far up until this point that I'm recording the show right now, it has to do with quarterbacks, and quarterback news is always interesting, or at least always clickable, I suppose, and this was no different. Andy Reid said that Tyler Bray is starting off as the number two quarterback for now for the Chiefs, with open competition heading in the training camp. That last sentence, open competition heading in the training camp, is the least surprising thing that could be said about the Chiefs' number two quarterback position. Obviously, that's the goal of what the Chiefs have done so far. So, as if you didn't know, here's a tiny bit about the three quarterbacks fighting for that spot. Tyler Bray was an undrafted free agent in 2013 who's been on the roster and in fact got a two-year extension last year, which I think a lot of people did not know, but has never been active for a game in the regular season. He's been on IR a ton. He had a torn ACL last year from a pickup basketball game. He's interesting. I'll talk about him specifically in a second. Aaron Murray was a fifth-round pick in 2014. Hogan was a fifth-round pick this April. Aaron Murray seemed to be the perfect candidate to step in to take over for Chase Daniel whenever Chase Daniel left, which was obviously always going to happen because he was too expensive. And the Chiefs were grooming a backup, essentially. And that was all very straightforward. So I guess it's a little bit surprising to that extent that it's Bray and not Murray right now. But Bray has the 1 year more of seniority here. That's totally unsurprising. What I think is going to be actually interesting, though, is not who is the number two quarterback, even through camp, but who the third quarterback is. Not just who's released, but who's the third quarterback and why. Easiest thing to say ever, Alex Smith. The Chiefs get their way. Alex Smith starts every game next year and potentially into the future because they don't have a clear developmental quarterback here. The steam around Paxton Lynch and even Johnny Manziel, if anybody wants to feel the joy of being patient about quarterbacks, be glad the Chiefs didn't draft Johnny Manziel when you wanted them to. But there was some speculation around Paxton Lynch being a Chief, even the Chiefs trading up in the first round to get Paxton Lynch. Didn't happen, obviously. Now he's a Bronco. We'll talk about the AFC West later on. But Tyler Bray is a very different kind of quarterback than Alex Smith, Aaron Murray, and Kevin Hogan. Murray and Hogan, both fifth round picks, both guys that are set here to be the next Chase Daniel. The jokes about Aaron Murray being the next Chase Daniel were outdone by the draft day jokes about Kevin Hogan being Chase Hogan or Kevin Daniel. It doesn't even matter because that is his not a ceiling necessarily, but that's the most likely thing that happens. Like if his career goes pretty well, he'll be Chase Daniel for 5 to 10 years, whatever that might end up being. And if you can be that consistent of a quarterback in Andy Reid's system, you will have a job for 10 years if you want it. I think Kevin Hogan and Aaron Murray are similar enough that the Chiefs don't need both of them. And I think the Chiefs know that. And I think that might be we might be seeing a tiny bit of that with Tyler Bray here. Not a ton, but a tiny bit. Tyler Bray is an entirely different type of quarterback. He's 6'6", he's 215 pounds, he's 24. He's young with great physical tools, a big arm. There are some concerns in college and out of the draft about his head. And if the Chiefs are still paying him money, and again, gave him a contract extension while he was injured, or before he was, I can't remember, but an extension without ever being active for a regular season game, the Chiefs are giving him money because I think they must be seeing something with Tyler Bray that's saying, you know what, he's soaking up this Andy Reid offense better than we thought he was going to, or better than the rest of the NFL thought he was going to be able to. He's growing. We're seeing him take advantage of his strengths while limiting his weaknesses. I'm absolutely putting words in their mouth at this point, but I think there's something to that extent that the Chiefs have to be seeing with Bray here. Not only to continue paying him, to put him in the number two spot here, which I don't put a lot of stock in, but to the guys they're bringing in to compete for this number two or number three quarterback spot, the other two guys are the same person. If Aaron Murray and Kevin Hogan are on, you know, if they tie exactly, and the Chiefs see nice potential from both of them, and neither one of them is really stepping over the other one, maybe they go, you know what, we've got to make sure we get the right guy here. Haven't figured it out yet, so we have to cut bait with Tyler Bray. But more than likely, I think they're going to say, we see something in Aaron Murray or Kevin Hogan that puts them above the other guy. That's who we're rolling with now, and Tyler Bray is the developmental quarterback. He's the guy with the best chance to be something special. And that chance is really tiny, honestly. Tyler Bray might have a 5% chance at being a special kind of quarterback in the NFL. Aaron Murray and Kevin Hogan might have half of that. They might each have 2% chance of being something special. But in reality, they both have, you know, a 35% chance of being Alex Smith. And I say Alex Smith with joy in my voice because he's been very good. And if you're new to the show and hate that take, you're going to hear a lot of it probably. I actually like Alex Smith as an NFL quarterback. I think most Chiefs fans do and should like him now. So if the Chiefs want to build more Alex Smiths, and if Andy Reid says, listen, I can run my offense with younger Alex Smiths for the rest of time, then they'll keep Murray and Hogan. But if they're saying, let's keep one of those two guys, let's make Kevin Hogan the next Alex Smith, because we don't have a whole lot of faith in Aaron Murray right now, and let's see what Tyler Bray can be. I think that is a very interesting thing to keep an eye on throughout training camp. I don't put a lot of stock into Tyler Bray being the number two guy right now. What I do put a lot of stock in is Murray and Hogan and Smith are all in the same mold. The Chiefs have kept a guy around that doesn't fit that mold for a couple of years now. I think they're doing that on purpose. Now for a short bit of self-promotion. I mentioned earlier about following me on Twitter at JB Briscoe. I want to reemphasize that one more time for old past listeners of the show and new listeners. I want you to tweet me because we don't have the luxury right now of a text line or open phones. We may have something like that in the future with Blog Talk Radio, but right now we don't. So for your voice to be heard, go to Twitter at JB Briscoe. Go to the comment sections of Arrowhead Addict and have conversations there with me or without me. I might chime in the comments. I might hold on to your comments and hoard them for the future and use them on the next show. But I want to make sure that your voice is heard on this show. If you think if I'm wrong somewhere, you disagree with something, you agree with something, you like a segment, you don't like something, or you have your own idea that it seemed like I haven't thought about. That happened last week and sparked a whole conversation topic that I hadn't even thought of. I love having those interactions. So you can do that on Twitter at JB Briscoe, Facebook.com/RTK Show, Arrowhead Addict on the show comments. If you want to support the show elsewhere, people have been doing it for a long time now with this show on patreon.com/RTK. That's patreon.com/RTK. You get a shout out on the show. I'll answer a question if you're in the $20 group with no questions asked. No pun intended. Twitter shout out, name shout out, whatever it is that it ends up saying on that website. And whatever you'd like. If you want to pay more, you can be a sponsor for an episode of the show. But right now, these people have been paying their own money to help keep this show free and help keep this show running for a while now. $20 group, Don Beal, at DonBeal32 on Twitter, Andy Simpson, Stephen Smith, and Derek Vaughn, at D_Vaughn88. $10 group, Ty DeClaire, at TyDeClaire44 on Twitter. $5 group, Josh Beadle. Thank you guys for volunteering that money every month to help keep this show rolling. It's gotten us this far, and now I hope we have great steps ahead with Blog Talk. The other thing that is super important is do not forget to subscribe somewhere. If it's on iTunes, on TuneIn, on Stitcher, anywhere else you get your podcasts, make sure you subscribe to Roughing the Kicker on any of those platforms. That way you never miss an episode when the publishing schedule is funky, when it takes longer to get to Arrowhead Addict and you're ready for your fix. Make sure you never miss another episode or even late to another episode. Again, subscribe somewhere so we're always in touch. Speaking of Arrowhead Addict, over on Arrowhead Addict last week, Matt Verderam put together some over-unders for some offensive players on the Chiefs, and these games are always fun. And also, speaking of Twitter, I want to know what you think about these over-unders. I'm going to give you the numbers, my logic, and where I would put my money if I were going to be putting money on over-unders for Chiefs offensive players, and I'm going to know your line of thinking, not only your picks, but why you lean that way for a particular player. I actually think this is a really fun game, so I hope that you enjoy this as much as I know I'm going to. Because we're all a little bit degenerate, I think. I think most NFL fans have that gambling streak that makes us more likely than the average person to take out a second mortgage on a home someday. The over-under set by Matt here on Arrowhead Addict, again, is for Alex Smith, is for touchdown passes right here. 22 touchdowns. And here's what Matt writes about it right off the top. Smith has only eclipsed this mark once in his career, doing it in 2013. The 32-year-old threw for 20 last season, after having a campaign where he failed to hit a receiver in the end zone for all 16 games the year previous to that, in case anybody forgot about the year with no touchdown passes to wide receivers. So last year, he hits a collective 20 passing touchdowns. I think 22, I understand that this is would be 22 on the dot would be one of his, would be his second best season of all time, passing this only in 2013. But this seems way too low for Alex Smith here. Now, he's not going to throw three touchdowns a game, but this is averaging like 1.5 touchdowns per game, and he blows past this. And I think he's going to. The one reason that I would argue against it is what I'll have to say about the running game pretty soon, but this is the best offense that the Chiefs have had in my lifetime. And I can say that pretty strongly, because the combination of, though there are better players in Chiefs history, there's not been a combination like this. No, Travis Kelce is not Tony Gonzalez. And Priest Holmes and Larry Johnson, that duo is eclipsing basically every running back duo that I can think of off the top of my head since I've been alive in the NFL. However, the trio of running backs the Chiefs have is incredible, possibly the best in the league. In fact, if you're going to say you have to take a trio of running backs, I'll take the Chiefs three. If you're going to say take a set of receivers, I will take Jeremy Maclin and anybody else over Eddie Kinnison and anybody else. And you want to argue maybe Trent Green and Alex Smith to say who's better at driving that offense? Well, I think we're going to find out, because Alex Smith is surrounded by weapons this year on offense. As long as the offensive line holds up, he's going to blow past 22. I think 25 is what I would set my number at and say this is where Alex Smith will end up this year, because he has Maclin, because I think good things are coming for Chris Conley, because he's going to be throwing the ball to Jamal Charles and Charkandrick West. There will be passes that Alex Smith throws 4 yards, they go for 14 or go for 40 because one of those playmakers takes it there. Again, Conley's explosive in this. Travis Kelce has some incredible downfield potential, especially once he has the ball in his hand already. This is all stuff that we've all seen. We've seen all of this, but I think this year, this is the chance for it all to actually come together and for Alex Smith to be the one to benefit from it. I think he's going to have a very, very nice season here. Now let's go to the ground. Two different 1,000-yard marks put up for betting here. Jamal Charles going 1,000 yards, and the combination, 1,000 yards rushing. And Charkandrick West and Spencer Ware going 1,000 yards combined rushing. I'm going to take the under on all of this, because I think all three of these guys are going to do really, really nice things for the Chiefs. I would rather put my money on West and Ware combining for 1,000 again. Charles has ended up with over 1,000 rushing yards every year that he's been healthy all year and has been a starter. And that's tremendous, and I still think very highly of Jamal Charles. I'm glad he's still on the team. I'm glad there was no absurd draft day trade to ship him off for a fourth-round pick to Miami or something. That would have been a huge step back, I think, for this offense. Even though I do believe in Charkandrick West and Spencer Ware. However, West is going to catch a lot of passes. Charles is going to catch a lot of passes. Ware is going to get he's going to get much less work. Both West and Ware will get much less work with Charles back in the rotation. But I think it is a rotation now. I think it's the most deadly rotation of three running backs in all of football. I think it is an absolutely deadly backfield. Having any of those two guys at the same time, having Charles and West in the backfield at the same time is going to be a matchup nightmare. You can hand to either guy, either up the middle or around the edge, and it's going to be hard to catch up. But more just devastatingly for defenses, what happens when those two guys both go out for passes? What if you set up for three guys wide and those two guys in the backfield? You let both of them run little wheel routes out of the backfield? There are no two linebackers. No team in football has linebackers that can cover both of those guys out of the backfield. That is never, ever going to happen. So I think this is a really fantastic trio, a three-headed monster if we're going to go straight to that. But I don't think any of those guys are going to run for... I don't think Charles will run for 1,000 yards by himself. I don't think that duo will run for 1,000 yards by their combined powers. However, I think we're going to see a really nice run game from this Chiefs team. Now let's go back to the air for the receivers. The pass catchers, Jeremy Maclin, 1,100 receiving yards. Now, Maclin in 2015 had 87 passes for just under 1,100 yards. 1,088 with 8 touchdowns. The year before that, with the Eagles, Macklin had over 1,300 receiving yards. This is getting just better than last year. Another year with Alex Smith, another year with Andy Reid. I want to believe this. I want to buy into this. In fact, I just wanted to give Chris Conley 900 yards a minute ago. I'm going to take the slight over here for Jeremy Macklin. I think he's up to speed now. I mean, he's already been up to speed with Andy Reid. He grew up in Andy Reid's system. But he's up to speed now, more importantly, with Alex Smith. And he's got guys apart from him on this offense that will demand coverage on the outside because we believe that Chris Conley is at least functional as a threat. I'll take the over on Jeremy Macklin. I'll take the under on the next one, Travis Kelce, 950 receiving yards. Travis Kelce, the last 2 years, ended up around 860 yards, 5 touchdowns. I think he is a tremendous talent, both physically as a receiver, his hands, his blocking ability, all around. He's a very well-rounded tight end. I don't think he's going to get to the 1,000-yard mark. I don't think he's going to get to the 950 because, again, there's a lot going on in this offense. And I think that's a great thing. I think this offense is going to fire on all cylinders, but I think Travis Kelce will end up with, again, less than 900 yards. And overall, a nice season whenever he really comes through in some big moments. As long as he can limit some of those mistakes, he's going to seem like he's giving more production than under 1,000 yards because he's going to show up in big moments, and he's going to create his own big moments. Next, Chris Conley at 400 receiving yards. I know that the 960-yard, 1,000-yard thing, comparisons to Antonio Brown, seems a little bit insane, and it seemed a little bit insane to me also. I love the way the logic comes together, and you say, well, this and this and this per game, and Chris Conley all of a sudden, boom, 1,000 yards. I'd love to believe in that. However, I'm a little bit hesitant, I think, for good reason. But let's go ahead and divide 400 by 16. It's 25 yards a game. I think Chris Conley will have a good shot. I think he will step past 400 yards pretty convincingly here. Now, Verderam writes again on Arrowhead Attic. Conley's going to have his work cut out for him to simply get on the field. The Chiefs went out and signed Rod Streeter in the offseason, along with Mike Williams. Also has Albert Wilson returning after starting in 2015. Doesn't even mention any of the rookie firepower coming in. Doesn't mention D'Anthony Thomas trying to stay on this team. The Chiefs had a problem that I don't think Rod Streeter and Mike Williams... What Streeter and Williams were brought in to fix is not a Chris Conley problem. The Chiefs have a depth problem at wide receiver. They've had that for quite a while now, and in the past, that depth has continued to be the second guy. Now Conley is the second guy. Also, drafting DeMarcus Robinson is the most important next guy up. But DeMarcus Robinson, what Rod Streeter, what Mike Williams, what those guys are all here to do, at least this year, Robinson is to develop. But Williams or Streeter, whichever one of those guys make it, and I do think it will only be one of those guys, they're in to be the third outside receiver. So if Conley struggles, you can plug in Streeter or Williams and get meaningful snaps from them. If Macklin or Conley get hurt, you can plug in Streeter or Williams and say, all right, this guy is going to give me something here. Maybe that ends up being Robinson later in the year. I'm not expecting that as a rookie from him. But I think Chris Conley is going to get number two wide receiver snaps, reps, and catches here. 25 yards a game, I'll absolutely take that for Chris Conley. Give me the over. The last one here is Albert Wilson for 600 receiving yards. Matt writes up for Wilson here. This is the third year for Wilson in the NFL after making Kansas City's team as an undrafted free agent, but now is the time. Wilson was a starter last season and only racked up 451 yards. Can he make the leap into respectability, or does he become an afterthought? It's very dramatic, Matt. Nice job. I think that's a little bit extreme. I'll indulge it for now, I suppose. I'm going to take the under on 600 for Albert Wilson because of what we've said about all these other weapons. The reason that Albert Wilson is going to lose yards or lose receptions and Chris Conley isn't going to is because Jamaal Charles can run the slot. We're going to see Charkendrick West catch more and more passes. I think Tyreek Hill is going to get involved on the offense on some level. If he doesn't, it'll be D'Anthony Thomas. It's going to be Tyreek Hill. There are so many weapons here. Also, Travis Kelce getting stuff across the middle. So many weapons here. Albert Wilson, a lot of his usage last year, especially late in the year, this was very strange to me. Using Wilson as like a field stretcher, as I talked about earlier, really bizarre. And that is not what he is set up to do. That is not his skill set. They can use him as a 500-yard slot receiver kind of guy. He's not going to be Wes Welker. He's not that sure-handed. He's not that good of a route runner, and he's certainly not the kind of guy that can stretch the field on demand. He will be a respectable piece of this offense. In fact, I think he will get a lot of snaps, but he's not even the most, again, when Jamaal Charles is back, Albert Wilson isn't even the most dynamic guy who can run the slot on this team. and it's not all that close. In fact, when D'Anthony Thomas was active, I might have taken D'Anthony Thomas to run the slot more often. I'm a little bit weirded out at the idea. The only thing with Tyreek Hill that really surprised me, other than they drafted a guy that beat and strangled his pregnant girlfriend, was that it was kind of giving. It felt like giving up on D'Anthony Thomas. And now I'm with how the roster shapes up, I don't think they will keep D'Anthony Thomas on the roster at all. I think he will find a home somewhere else, just like Dexter McCluster did. But giving up on D'Anthony Thomas that quickly was strange to me, because I would have loved to have seen him do more in the slot and have him do more stuff stretching the field. Albert Wilson does not have that kind of speed. Let's go back to the comments on Arrowhead Addict once again, because Roger had something interesting to say in the comments of last show. He said, Marcus Cooper is going to be put opposite of Marcus Peters. He's the veteran of the corners, nearly as big as what we lost in Sean Smith. Gaines will be the slot. Rest of the 5'11 rookie crowd will battle for backup spots. So now we're talking about the secondary here. I still think there's a better chance that Marcus Cooper is cut than that he is starting day one. But I think this is very interesting. I think the whole Chiefs staff would love to start a veteran, opposite of Peters especially. But the Chiefs have brought in so many corners that I don't think that they have in any way sort of pre-stacked the deck to show up in favor of the vet. I think they're going to have the best performers show up outside, and I don't think that's going to end up being Marcus Cooper. In fact, along with Jamel Fleming, Cooper has gotten, and apparently still is getting, some work at safety, which is super interesting. Roger also said that Sorensen, Parker, and Barry should be the safeties. Fleming blows and won't make the team. Let me talk about the safeties here for a second, because I disagree. I think losing Tyvon Branch and Hussein Abdullah is a big blow, especially Abdullah, who just retired. Tyvon Branch is now in Arizona. Here's how the safeties shape up a little bit. I think it's pretty interesting. I think Stevie Brown will be serviceable as that kind of fourth guy among the safeties. I think he can do Tyvon Branch type things. We said the same thing that he's saying about Jamel Fleming. Jamel Fleming blew at playing cornerback. Frankly, Ron Parker was a terrible outside corner. He was a disaster outside. Then he got moved to safety, played some incredibly good slot corner, and played safety unbelievably efficiently. Overall, one of the most valuable players on this Chiefs defense last year. I think you could argue maybe the most valuable player on the Chiefs team. If you just took him off, the rest of the team falls apart. Although Marcus Peters, Sean Smith all would have had that same effect also. But keeping the semantics out of it, Ron Parker was fantastic. Now, just give me this bit of imagination. Jamel Fleming is a similar size to Ron Parker and will be making that transition with the same coaches that Parker did. Now, again, Marcus Cooper has some intriguing size, some intriguing skill, has been a part of this team for a while, this system for a while. If they think he can step in at safety and make some plays there, I am at least very willing to see that start to play out in the preseason, maybe even into the actual season itself. I am not feeling that quick of a trigger on this safety group, even though I was very critical of the Chiefs for franchising Eric Berry in lieu of Sean Smith. I still think to this day they should have kept Tyvon Branch, made all of these moves they've made at safety. Maybe some of those corners they drafted ended up being new safeties. Let Eric Berry go to Tennessee or wherever and keep Sean Smith for one more year. I will still stand on that soapbox. That's how I would have handled it at the time. I feel a little bit better because the Chiefs have invested so heavily in the cornerback position here, not only veterans, but also all of these young guys, the draftees, the undrafted guys they brought into rookie minicamp and all of that. I feel better now than I did, but not exactly fantastic. Overall, though, I think the Marcus Cooper call is very interesting. I think ultimately it's going to be Kavari Russell opposite Marcus Peters day one for the Chiefs, which is going to be kind of insane to have a rookie and a second-year player, defensive rookie of the year, but still a second-year player, basically deciding the fate of your defense, especially in the passing game. It's going to be a scary proposition, but it's what the Chiefs signed up for when they let Sean Smith go. Let's talk about a guy who's not on the team right now and probably never will be on the team, but some of you want him on the team, so we're going to go ahead and talk about him. Ronald Leary. Let's start with something from ESPN. Cowboys guard Ronald Leary has requested a trade from the Cowboys and has been a no-show for the offseason programs, including the start of organized team activities on Tuesday, according to sources. Leary signed his restricted free agent tender worth $2.5 million before the draft in hopes of facilitating a trade. Cowboys executive vice president Stephen Jones of the team received a few inquiries during the three-day draft, but would not just, quote, give him away. His schedule is to be an unrestricted free agent after this season. This kind of came and went past my eyes without a whole lot of interest peaking, if you will. But Ben Almquist, who's at Citadel Chief, writes for Arrowhead Addict. I disagree with him all the time. I think he's also one of the smartest Chiefs fans and Chiefs writers that I know. He says, really, this is almost an ideal situation for the Chiefs. He's affordable, very talented, and a short-term option. He continues and said, on May 10th, the Chiefs added three interior offensive linemen to the roster. Makes me think that they're still looking for an answer at guard. Leary is an answer. I still like Anger a lot at guard, but giving him the backseat to Leary this year would make a lot of sense. I agree that giving the rookie Anger a backseat to an established guy is nice. But I also think that right now the Chiefs have a pretty good crop of offensive linemen in the middle. I said to Ben, with Anger, Zach Fulton, Laron Duvernay-Tardif, and Ja Reed, I don't think we're at a tremendous risk of seeing the Chiefs fall down a hole like they did a few years ago with Linkenbach and McGlynn and just a dissolving, disappearing offensive line. I don't think that risk is actually there. I think all four of those guys can all still play. But Ben said that Reed is taking over for right guard for LDT, which Reed did end up playing at the end of last season. And I think, again, Reed could play guard very well. He's taking over the right guard spot for LDT, which is not a good thing for LDT. Fulton has struggled bad at guard, and Anger is an offensive tackle convert. Those things are all reasonably true. And Ben was also talking with Arrowhead Pride. Arrowhead Pride on Twitter said, a mid-round pick, no shot. I don't think he makes that much of a difference. Guard is a low priority here. Ben, though, said, are you willing to risk a disaster like a couple years back? So let me try to pull that together here. For where I'm at with Leary, where I think the Chiefs are at with Leary. For the right price, whatever that might actually be, I wouldn't mind seeing the Chiefs trade for this guy. But to give up a mid-round asset for a guy who might not even see the field and, you know, is getting shipped out of Dallas right now, I would pass and invest in the guys who are already in the building. I know I have a little bit of Ben Grubbs remorse. Paul Fanica from the Cardinals, the Chiefs gave him a nice deal. The Chiefs have swung and missed bad on two veteran guards recently with Fanica and Grubbs. Giving up a pick to a guy here with Leary, if they were to trade for him, the next question would be, are you giving him a longer term contract? His deal this year is fine, $2.5 million for one season, that's fine. But if you're going to give up a fourth round pick for that guy, by the way, you know, Kevin Hogan talked about, and Aaron Murray were fifth round picks. People love taking developmental quarterbacks. You want to give up your chance at a developmental quarterback next year with a fourth or fifth round pick? Fifth round pick is what it costs for Ben Grubbs, and Ben Grubbs stunk. He was bad before he got hurt. Don't forget that. Then he got hurt, and you know, he was no longer on the team. I'm not super sold on giving up a meaningful pick for 1 year of an offensive guard. And again, I think though Fulton has had his struggles, I think he's made great strides, although he might be best at center, actually, but Mitch Morse is not moving and should not move. Mitch Morse should be the center on this team for years and years to come. But you let Reed and Fulton and LDT fight out for those guard spots. The other one of them ends up being a backup. And if Reed ends up not getting a starting spot, he can also play the swing tackle position, which is also fantastic. The Chiefs can go into next season without a ton of depth by numbers because they have depth by versatility for the offensive linemen. They've got those guys can all play guard. Reed can play either tackle spot. Fisher and Mitchell Schwartz are going to be the starting tackles. Mitch Morse is the center. Fulton can play center if Morse gets hurt. There's a lot of flexibility there. The problem is maybe none of those guys are good enough. If none of those guys are good enough, then the Chiefs should trade for Ronald Leary. I think the Chiefs are going to be rolling with those four guys as their front lines. I think the rest of those guys that they brought in are competition numbers. Maybe they do think that Reed is best suited to be able to swing to either guard spot, to either tackle spot, or they feel like they have to carry another versatile lineman because Morse and Fulton and Reed can all play multiple positions. Don't really know that about LDT. His time at tackle has been no bueno. So I think the Chiefs are bringing in more competition bodies for camp, more guys that can challenge for backup spots. Because I think it's flawed logic to say, well, the Chiefs are bringing in The Chiefs added three veteran offensive linemen, or just added three interior offensive linemen. They don't think, the Chiefs don't think any of those guys are going to be starting at all. Not even day one, but like at all. That would be a disaster in all likelihood. The guys they want to be starting are the guys they've invested in. Morse, Inger, Fisher, and Schwartz. There are four of them there. They invested a little bit into Zach Fulton. They've invested time and development into LDT. They've invested money into Ja Reed. Those guys are here to start eventually. And if they're not going to start, all of those guys can be really, really good backups. That's by my estimation. Ben disagrees. You may disagree. The Chiefs may disagree. We'll find out pretty soon. Ultimately, though, I think the Chiefs are going to stand pat with the guards they currently have. Unless somebody gets released, somebody like Leary, who is just below the cut line for a good offensive line. If one of those guys gets released as roster cutdowns start to come around, we might see the Chiefs go and swoop in and bring in one of those guys. That's essentially what happened with Ja Reed. Keep in mind, he was not on the roster until late in the game, and then ended up starting week one for an injured Eric Fisher at left tackle against J.J. Watt. Which is, right tackle. It was right tackle, because Donald Stevenson was at left tackle, and Donald Stevenson is also no longer on the team. This offensive line has come a long way in a calendar year. Now for a segment that I've been teasing for about a month now almost. Let's take a look around the rest of the AFC West and see what's been going on. Bill Barnwell put together for ESPN.com, put together some report cards for each team in the AFC West. And I think this will give us a nice way to start talking about these teams before we expand on each of them. He has a what went right and what went wrong section for each team here. Let's go ahead and start with the Broncos, alphabetical order, I suppose. What went right? The first one, I hope, makes you smile, because it makes me smile. They quietly might have upgraded at quarterback. Let's read that again. They quietly might have upgraded at quarterback. Barnwell writes, "It's weird to say about a team that won a Super Bowl and subsequently lost its Hall of Fame starter and its promising backup during the same offseason, but it's entirely possible that the Broncos will get better quarterback play out of Mark Sanchez in 2016 than they did out of Peyton Manning and Brock Osweiler last season. During his two-season under Chip Kelly in Philadelphia, Sanchez posted a QBR of 55. I'm not so confident in QBR's ability to account for scheme changes to say that Sanchez definitely outplayed Manning and Osweiler, but it's at least in the realm of discussion to suggest that he could be at a similar level to 2016 as those guys did in 2015. Given that Sanchez will have a cap hit of just $4.5 million and cost a 7th-round pick, while Manning in 2015 and Osweiler over 16 and 17 were each going to cost in excess of $17 million per year, the Broncos may be better off with Sanchez." Now, the end of that I agree with the most. Getting Sanchez for $4.5 million is probably better for a football team than getting Brock Osweiler for $17. However, the quarterback position is, in my mind, the most fascinating position in American sports. Because it not only can elevate, a great quarterback can elevate a bad team, obviously, but the most important thing might be, or the more thing that comes across more teams more frequently, is when average quarterbacks limit very good teams. That's the fear with Alex Smith. I've never been concerned about Alex Smith not being good enough to make a bad team good. He was never brought to Kansas City to make a bad team good. Mark Sanchez is not going to Denver to make a bad team good. He has to make a good team, or even a great team, stay at that level of being good to great. Last year, that Broncos defense was a gem, and he has some fantastic weapons around him. He's got to utilize those. Now, I would argue that actually would take the Chiefs' weapons this year, which is terrifying to think about. He's got to utilize those weapons. If he can utilize those weapons, the Broncos will win the division again, because that defense is not going to take a large step backwards. Mark Sanchez, He's the cap. He is the cap on the Broncos' potential. The Broncos can only be as good as Mark Sanchez to the extent they were only as good as Peyton Manning, and Peyton Manning wasn't very good last year. To talk about Peyton Manning and Brock Osweiler combining for that QBR, if nothing else, further illustrates how good that defense was. So I would say an upgrade is something is strong. I'm not that faithful in Mark Sanchez. But to say that the Broncos won't be totally hampered by average quarterback play, yeah, I would agree, because that they won a Super Bowl with at best average quarterback play last year. Another good thing that happened to the Broncos, according to Barnwell, and it, you should agree with, they found a left tackle on the cheap. Left tackle was a mess last year for the Broncos, who lost Ryan Clady and then rookie Ty Cimbrello to season-ending injuries by the end of September. Ryan Harris eventually filled in before leaving for Pittsburgh. Enter Russell Okung, who critically misjudged the importance of agents by trying to represent himself in free agency. Okung ended up signing a massively Broncos-friendly contract. His 5-year, $53 million deal has no guaranteed money and will earn Okung only up to $5 million this year if he makes the Denver roster. After the season, Denver gets to decide whether they want to pick up an option that will basically give Okung 2 guaranteed seasons for a total of $21 million, with 2 additional non-guaranteed seasons tacked on at the end for $25 million more. It's about as unfavorable of a deal as a player can sign entering free agency. You have to feel bad for Okung, given that this might be his only shot at securing a big-money second contract, but it's a great deal for Denver. And by signing Okung, they were able to deal Clady in a 7th-round pick to the Jets for a 5th-rounder. The Russell Okung story, which I think we talked about at the time on this show, is fascinating. That he didn't want to pay an agent, and he lost way, way more money than he saved by not paying an agent. So that was a nice move for the Broncos, and it gives them more cap flexibility. The scariest thing about what the Broncos have done is they were in a bad cap space with Peyton Manning's contract. They didn't want to pay Brock Osweiler. Well, they went cheap with quarterback, with Mark Sanchez and Paxton Lynch. They got cheaper on the offensive line. They have more flexibility now, which is not good news for anyone else in the AFC West. What went wrong, though, for the Broncos? Here's the part we're all looking forward to. A lot of useful players walked out the door. Manning, Osweiler, Malik Jackson, Danny Trevathan, Evan Mathis, Luis Vasquez, Owen Daniels. And he said some of those names are bigger than their actual on-field impact, but there's a lot of talent that left Denver here. Free agency, getting cut, getting traded, in the case of Ryan Clady, retirement. There are good reasons here. Broncos didn't want to pay up in places they didn't have to, and I get it, but that's a team that just won the Super Bowl based off of their defense and the talent around their quarterbacks. They lost a lot of strong talent there. And now here's something that I think is interesting that Barnwell points out. He writes, what was interesting is that the Broncos didn't really pursue like-for-like replacements outside of swapping Clady for Okung. They did add Jared Crick for a nice low-cost replacement for Jackson. Their other offseason signing was Donald Stevenson. Pause for Donald Stevenson. Just a Donald Stevenson moment here. All right. Who likely started at right tackle and pushed the disappointing Michael Schofield into a reserve role. Denver didn't sign a guard despite cutting both starters with the idea that they'll move Cimbrello inside after signing Okung. So there's a few things that went wrong. Another thing that is written here, they bungled the C.J. Anderson situation. This is super interesting, too. Essentially what happened is they tendered him at the lowest level they could justifiably, which would save them some cap money. Then the Dolphins offered Anderson a 4-year, $18 million deal with the tender. And then the Broncos essentially said, all right, we weren't going to pay this guy an extra $800,000. Well, now because the Dolphins hiked the price up, we're now going to give you $6 million guaranteed in 2016. So they whiffed on that. Barnwell gives them a C on the offseason. They also haven't signed Von Miller yet. Offseason grades are almost as silly as draft ones, but at least they're with players who have actually been in the NFL before, not totally unknown rookies. Let's go to the most interesting team here, and the team I might spend even more time on than the Broncos, the Oakland Raiders. What went right? They continue to invest in their offensive line. Build it onto that. I'm going to scan through that because it's offensive line. I understand the names aren't that important, but they continue to bolster their offensive line. The biggest thing that we all know happened is they upgraded their secondary in a huge, huge way. The Raiders have made some moves in the past that Barnwell describes as desperate. Well, now look at what they did in this singular offseason. They signed Sean Smith from the Chiefs, Barnwell calls him a legitimately above average cornerback. He is a very good cornerback, even still. By the end of his contract, maybe he won't be. But in the meantime, everyone here listening to their show knows my thoughts on Sean Smith. I wish the Chiefs still had him. I wish we would have franchised him and made the Raiders move on. Barnwell goes on, then they picked up a pair of starting safeties in Reggie Nelson, who posted a league-high 8 interceptions last season, and first-round pick Carl Joseph, who will slot in at strong safety and has drawn comparisons to Bob Sanders. If Mack and fellow addition Bruce Irvin, who's also added to their defense, can hold up to their end of their bargain rushing quarterback, this would quickly turn into a very scary pass defense. And it is. The only thing they didn't do was upgrade at running back. They stood pat with Latavius Murray, and who was not as strong last season as he has been in the past, but he is an explosive running back, and it's not easy to find top-tier running backs, but if you have to somewhere roll the dice on a bunch of guys in training camp, look at the Chiefs' back half of their running back depth chart, and you'll find guys who were barely on rosters, apart from Jamaal Charles, obviously. So that's neither here nor there, I suppose. Also, a thing that isn't even touched on in this offseason report, their offense is not only continuing to add pieces apart from the offensive line, but just around the entire offense. This is something you can't really quantify now, but you're looking at guys like Derek Carr and Amari Cooper getting years into their experience now. The development, the jump that should be coming for those guys, and not only should be coming, like, well, the projections say, and, you know, the numbers suggest, and stat sheets would indicate, real on-field, watching these guys play, watching what Derek Carr does, watching Amari Cooper, these guys are getting better. This is something even more than talking about Chris Conley, where we say, you know, he should be taking a step forward because it's his next year in the system. We didn't see much from Chris Conley. We saw a little bit, and he got better when we saw him. But guys like, but Carr and Amari Cooper are pushing and pushing and pushing to new levels already. That's not going to stop after 1 year for Amari Cooper, 2 years for Derek Carr. I think that offense is going to be very, very interesting. The Chargers, also the Raiders got a B+, if anyone cares. The Chargers, I'm going to skim through it, because honestly, I think they're the least interesting team right in the AFC West right now. They invested heavily in their defense. They went and drafted Joey Bosa at number 3 overall. They added a lot of talent. They lost some talent. They added a lot of talent. They also got deeper along the offensive line. They brought back Ken Wisenhunt's offensive coordinator. Great. But over to what went wrong, they destroyed Eric Weddle. And not only in the off-the-field stuff with San Diego and LA and everything, but now Eric Weddle has said that San Diego is dead to him, because that contract negotiation went so poorly, and he still has years of productivity left. He's in Baltimore now, so they ran him out of town. Also, Barnwell points out they overpaid for Travis Benjamin. They had to bring in a third receiver, and they had all the injuries and everything last year, so that they paid a heavy price for Travis Benjamin. Barnwell says the next thing on the Chargers roster, and I would agree with this wholeheartedly, the next thing on their to-do list even would be to re-sign Keenan Allen, or to get him on an actual contract that's paying him closer to what he deserves, because they need weapons. Again, maybe more than any other team in the division, they lack explosive weapons. And that's ultimately going to hamper them. We think Phillip Rivers is on his way down, I think we've seen the best of Phillip Rivers. We've seen the best of those guys around him. The defense is going in a better direction. Everyone wants to compare Joey Bosa to J.J. Watt. Let's actually wait and see, why don't we? The Chargers are going in the wrong direction. And last year was the worst instance of that, because looking back on that team, and even at the time, I remember previewing the games and everything, the Chargers had talent, but the injuries were so rampant on that team that if I ran into a Chargers fan who was especially optimistic about next season, I would hear him out. I could understand saying, well, listen, everything went wrong last year at just about every position. And, you know, so we ended up with a third pick, had a nice draft, all going uphill from here. Somebody's got to finish last in this division. And I think the Chiefs have some crazy talent. Justin Houston being not a part of the defense anymore, or until he gets healthy, obviously, scares me quite a bit. The inexperience in the secondary is worrisome. The inexperience, or at least the lack of success from Dee Ford, along with Tamba Hali being old, the pass rush worries me. The defensive line is going to be fantastic. The offense, I feel great about. You're going to give a checkmark to special teams, sure thing. I feel pretty good about where the Chiefs are right now, and I think the Broncos have the best defense in the division, probably the best defense in the league still, off the top of my head, but definitely the best defense in the division. They have a couple of the best weapons in the division. Demaryius Thomas is the best weapon in the division. And if you think Jamaal Charles comes back healthy, you could argue that, I guess, but I'm not going to. And the Raiders have, and I know I get this every time I talk about the Raiders, Chiefs fans snicker and brush them off because they're the Raiders, and I get it. I understand. The Raiders have been terrible for as long as I've been paying attention to football. But man, it's a young core going in the right direction. If you took Raiders off, if you switch the rosters of the Raiders and the Jags, the Jaguar Raiders, I guess, with the Raiders roster, would be the sneaky pick to make a nice run. You know, the team really set up well, made a good decision at quarterback, got a great quarterback in the second round, went and got a big playmaker to go with them, really building on the offensive line, really putting together a heck of a defense, which with a nice combination of drafted guys and big money free agents, a team that really seems to be built the right way. Honestly, if they weren't called the Raiders, if they didn't have that stigma and that logo, I think everybody would go, this team is on the way up. They're not like some team doomed to go 5-11, because we're used to seeing that because we're Chiefs fans and we watch the Raiders as close as we watch anybody else every year. I don't think they're doomed to that whatsoever. I think with the Chargers looking up from the basement, I think there's a three-team race to be had in the AFC West right now. I'll go through the schedule, if not next, not next show, very, very soon, and do the first two early schedule prediction. But I think, and I will do it for all three, all the whole division. I think we're going to end up with a very, very interesting race. One other thing with the Raiders, I didn't buy in to the idea of the Raiders moving to Las Vegas for quite a while, but it seems like that story actually has legs. Here's from Pro Football Talk. Commissioner Roger Goodell said little on Tuesday about a potential move of the Raiders to Las Vegas. Raiders owner Mark Davis said plenty. Quote, I'm excited about it, Davis said in comments televised on NFL Network. It's a new market. It's got the potential to be a really exciting market. The Raider fan in Northern California get a little upset whenever we talk about going to Los Angeles, and the LA fans get a little ticked off to the fans in Northern California, so it seems like Las Vegas is a neutral site that everybody's kind of bought into. It will unite the Raider Nation more than divide it. Asked if this means he's given up on staying in Oakland, Davis said, no. Then he said, I've given my commitment to Las Vegas, and if they can come through with what we've talked about doing, then we'll go to Las Vegas. All right, that sounds like a real thing. I do believe that they haven't given up on Oakland, but it does sound like the Raiders very much have a second plan, a plan for if Oakland says, nope, not going to build you a stadium, which they shouldn't. They should pay for their own stadium. That's a different show. Well, someday in the offseason, we'll talk about the absurdity of states and counties having to pay for professional stadiums. But I digress for now. If Oakland says, nope, not going to do it, not going to budge, the Raiders can go to Las Vegas. And I think in a lot of cases, a lot of teams moving to Vegas wouldn't make sense, and the Raiders moving to a lot of places wouldn't make sense. The Los Angeles Raiders, obviously because of history, would be fine. Anywhere else, though, I think they're the Oakland Raiders. Having the Raiders go to, I mean, this is absurd, but to have the Raiders go to St. Louis would be really strange. Having the Raiders go to Las Vegas, it kind of makes sense. I don't know why. I can't quantify it super well, but because they're the pirate team, the kind of the rule breaking team, for the duration of the NFL's existence, they've kind of been that pesky team that gets under everybody's skin. That's their whole identity as the Raiders. So having that be the team that goes to Las Vegas, the first professional American sports franchise to go to Vegas and have that be their home, I'm kind of cool with that. That sounds kind of fun. That's going to do it for this episode of the Rough and the Kicker Kansas City Chiefs podcast. I'm your host, Joshua Briscoe. Let me know if you liked the show, didn't like the show, things you did and didn't like, things you would or wouldn't change on Twitter at JBBriscoe, B-R-I-S-C-O. If you're a new listener from Blog Talk Radio, welcome to the party. If you're a longtime listener, thanks for sticking around. You know, support the show by leaving a review on iTunes, subscribing to the show wherever you can, which is supremely important to me, or at patreon.com/RTK. You can donate a little bit of money to keep this show rolling, although I think this show now is rolling very, very quickly in a very, very good direction, thanks to Blog Talk. I'm really excited to see what happens next. I can tell you also, I'm very close to actually having the type of software that I need to have on guests more frequently, especially throughout the off season, so it will not just be my annoying little toddler voice doing this show for an hour every week. If you like the show, tell a friend. If you didn't like it, tell a friend. This is Rough and the Kicker. I'm Joshua Briscoe. Hope you enjoyed your time here today. Bye, Mom.
Excuse me, sir, but could you drop the bass?